And now, your ChillPack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Hey everybody, it's Dean Haglund here in the offices of Rational Exuberance, high above the historic core of downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. I'm here with your co-host, my Mr. Phil Lernis, ladies and gentlemen.
Happy President's Day.
Oh, it is President's.
All of you in the United States of America, and to everybody else, happy Monday.
Up in Canada, happy Louis Riel Day.
Is it the Louis Riel Day?
Yes. They didn't have it when I was a kid, but now it's Louis Riel Day. We celebrate the Métis Rebellion.
Who is Louis Riel?
Louis Riel was the head of the Métis Rebellion against the government in the 1800s, and then they hung him for treason and sold the rope.
It's certainly good that they didn't hang him.
In Canada, we hung him in plural.
Like you would curtains.
Exactly.
All right.
And then
yes, more politics. Please continue.
No. Then a guy sold the rope for $1 an inch, and then it was so popular he bought another 10,000 feet of rope.
Is that how you got the idea of selling your hair?
Exactly.
When you cut Langley's hair?
Time-honored Canadian tradition. That's exactly correct.
You know, there is so many contradictory words in the phrase time-honored Canadian tradition.
What? That is insulting, sir, here on President's Day.
As Canadian as possible, given the circumstances.
Well, and as a Canadian, I still celebrate George Washington and Lincoln's birthday separately, so I took last Monday and the following Monday off. This day I'm working, so...
Do Canadians celebrate either of their birthdays?
No. No, but I remember as a kid, there was like six presidents' birthdays that you all took off, and then finally they coalesced them into one day.
So this is the calm before the storm for us at your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And, you know, if what I hear is true, and the rumors are always true, you know that.
I know that. I live by rumors.
We've been positively killing it on this show lately. That's what I've been hearing from people.
Really?
Next week's show is an annual tradition on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. It's our post-Oscar smackdown.
A total smackdown.
High-stakes wagering where we reveal who we predicted would win in each of the Academy categories.
And we go right down to short animated, the live-action shorts. Don't kid yourself.
I think it's 24 this year. 24 categories, all of them.
Right.
And starting last year, we actually brought into the mix some fun audio bonus material, and yes, we're going to be doing so again this year.
Fantastic.
So and in fact, I think last year's Oscar show was one of our most popular, but if you haven't availed yourself of that, it's there, as are all but at this point 70 episodes of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, hollywood.com. And that's, of course, thanks to our good friends, our hosts at Blog Talk Radio.
Yes.
So this is going on next Monday, and as soon as we are done with today's show, I will be filling out my ballot.
Mine's already filled up.
You will be signing it. You will be keeping them. And this year, we had not decided on what the wager was.
That's true. Because last year's wager still goes...
We still haven't paid... We're 2 years remiss, though I have, when I volunteered, even though I won, to go ahead and... honor the wager as if I had lost by running a 10K for charity.
Right, remember that?
That was the year that you were going to watch a David Lynch marathon of films, which don't have to be all in one sitting, I'm realizing.
Oh, okay.
So what I might do to speed this up along is fortnightly assign you a David Lynch film.
See, that seems palatable.
And then I will question you on it to hold your feet to the fire. So I think that might
like
be a good way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I might even go so far as to provide you the discs themselves.
Well, now that's even more helpful.
So, but you'll be pleased to learn that this last week, since seeing you a week ago, I have actually officially begun training for the 10K.
Come on.
So this will happen. And then last year, of course, in losing... the wager was that I needed to paint my first ever canvas. Yes. My first ever painting of any kind.
Right.
So we will figure out when and how to get that started.
Uh-huh.
This year, because we have all these bets, these wagers to pay off, I thought this needs to be something that is already on the agenda, something that we need to work out. We know that you're going to be relocating down under.
Down under.
Where it is 17 hours ahead tomorrow. I don't know if that even made sense in a Stephen Hawking sense.
I'm but going into the future.
Whatever time it is now,
yeah.
In Australia,
right?
It's 17 hours later.
Tomorrow, yeah. So it's like technically...
We're recording this around noon on Monday here in...
Los Angeles.
75 degrees.
So it'll be 7 a.m.
It's about, we're saying...
7 and 8.
Well, that would be more than 17 hours.
It's 7:13 right now, a.m.
So it's 19 hours.
19 ahead. Hours.
Okay. So it's 19 hours ahead. So what I was thinking we could do, which poses a dilemma.
It is.
Because if we're going to keep this being a weekly Monday show.
Right.
And I think certainly that's our aim.
It's been 8 years now.
Are we recording it on your Monday or on my Monday? And at what time are we doing it? And given the fact that also there might be some editing involved now, depending on what technology allows for us and what the best way is to do this, and we're researching it, I thought the winner of the wagering could be the one to dictate when the show gets recorded.
Like it.
Is that good?
That is good.
Because it's something we had to decide anyway.
Right.
And it's not something that has to be decided in the moment.
No. And if I could
it can be decided once you're there.
Exactly. And I could be a total dick about it and make you get up at 3 a.m.
Right. Although, I love the idea, again, since it's 19 hours, I love the idea that you decide to do that and then you get the math wrong. And so it ends up that we're both screwed.
Yeah, exactly. We're both just falling asleep at the mic. Oh, dear Lord, what time is it? Yeah.
That'd so be that'll awesome. Be our wager.
I like it.
On next week's Oscar show.
Okay.
You know, last night was an occasion that almost felt like an awards gala.
Uh-huh.
It was the 40th anniversary of Saturday Night Live.
It was.
Black tie, red carpet affair.
Mm-hmm. I didn't watch it.
Really?
Yeah.
What a huge disappointment, since so many people wanted us to talk about it.
Oh, is that right? You should have warned me. SNL was never a big part of my life. I was SCTV.
Well, we'll talk about this. But it was at 3.5 hours, again, felt like an award show.
Right.
Unlike an award show, it was a great two-hour show stretched out over 3.5 hours.
Right.
Which people are complaining about, though I would argue that that is in keeping with the history of Saturday Night Live.
Exactly. There's
where you have 45 minutes stretched out over...
an hour and a half.
What's interesting, though, is it ran counter to Saturday Night Live in that you know when the commercials start to happen more often during Saturday Night Live, the quality of the sketches are going to thin out.
Right.
On last night's show, the more often there were commercials... the higher the likelihood that the material between those commercials was actually top notch. The show got funnier as it went along.
That's
it really
rare.
Did. It is rare. It started off very poorly with Jimmy Fallon and Justin Timberlake doing an awards type opening number.
Right.
But by the time in the last hour or so, you have Bill Murray reprising Nick Ocean, his lounge singer character. You have Jerry Seinfeld coming up and taking questions from the exclusively star-studded audience, including Michael Douglas demanding to know why he was only allowed to host once. and Jerry Seinfeld trying to make him feel better by saying, you shouldn't feel bad. You've had a wonderful career. And Douglas goes, no, I don't need to hear that. I know I'm Hollywood royalty and a sexual icon. I just would like to have been asked,
then
he lists some of the people who were allowed to, and then Seinfeld held court about, I always thought it was sad when people hosted more often, like they didn't have anything else going on. So there were really, really funny moments.
That is funny.
But what I was going to say was, from the moment of the red carpet arrivals, I kind of realized what was missing from most awards shows. Well, maybe all awards shows.
Is.
Which is everyone who arrived and walked that red carpet and was interviewed beforehand, in addition to doing Brian Williams jokes that fell flat.
Of course.
they clearly were all there for something they loved.
Ah.
So the energy just on the red carpet itself was so much fun.
Right. Everybody had a smile, a genuine smile on their
face. So although it wasn't a great show could have come out of it.
Right.
Because everybody was really there in honor of something. When you talk about it being around for 40 years, I mean, that is as long a record as many of these award shows that are treated with such tradition.
I know. And you think about the award shows. I mean, it's fine to do the Oscars. That would be exciting. But when you have so many... It's almost nightly now, running up to the Oscars. Of course you're going to be weary. You're going to say the same things on the red carpet over and over again. It's going to be a complete nightmare. So that's why I think the ratings, you've thinned out the exclusivity so much on the award shows.
So there were some real comedic highlights. Will Ferrell reprising Alex Trebek in Celebrity Jeopardy.
All right.
Was terrific. A sketch that I never particularly enjoyed, but I think the audience, both in the studio and at home, really enjoyed was the Californians.
Really?
So there were some real highlights, and it was exciting to see Eddie Murphy walk out onto that stage looking like $1 million,
looking like
a prize fighter at 55 years of age.
Uh-huh.
First time he'd been there in more than 30 years.
I bet.
And Chris Rock's introduction of him was electrifying, and it was a wonderful introduction. And one of the things that Chris Rock pointed out was that he himself and Kevin Hart and every black comedian who especially would appear on Saturday Night Live during the years would always be hailed as the next Eddie Murphy.
Ah,
and plus. Chris Rock said, there is no next Eddie Murphy. There would never be another Eddie Murphy. There is only one Eddie Murphy, and this is Eddie Murphy. And that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there's only one Chris Rock.
Right.
And as exciting as it was to see Eddie Murphy take the stage, and he was only there for 78 seconds, and it was a long and awkward 78 seconds wherein I found myself wishing that the great Eddie Murphy... I just kind of wished that maybe he was a little more like Chris Rock.
See?
Who would be able to at least, off the cuff, share an anecdote.
Right, of something. But anyway, you know, my friends work with him, and it's a disappointing experience working with him on set. And I imagine now that he's just taken that work ethic of sort of being standoffish to being on live television now.
The Return of Wayne's World sketch was kind of fun in that it gave another opportunity for Dana Carvey to remind us that, boy, he still has it.
Does he really?
I don't know if you ever have... So you've not been watching the web series that he did that
no.
Mark Hirschhorn was a part of.
No.
Yeah, he is so sharp and so funny. And why not? I mean, just because he's been out of the public eye doesn't mean... And oh, by the way,
the web
of
series?
All these people... has aged so well and looks so healthy and so happy.
Wow.
And that informs. Another guy like that was Martin Short, nailed it, just killed it. Of
As
course,
he does.
SCTV alum before he'd ever been on Saturday Night
Absolutely.
Live.
Absolutely, brought the characters over.
That one amazing year where they weren't sure if the show would continue or how they would continue it,
right.
Coming out of the Eddie Murphy years. And so it was the one time they offered contracts established performers.
Right.
Martin Short, Christopher Guest, Harry Shearer, Billy Crystal. They would do that again about 10 years hence,
right.
With what is generally regarded as the most disappointing cast, which included Robert Downey Jr.
Right.
Janine Garofalo.
Oh, yeah. That's right. They're in the same year.
Who else? Anthony Michael Hall. Randy Quaid.
Yes. All of them.
So it didn't work then, but it did work, obviously, in that Christopher Guest year.
Right.
Though, really, when you think of it, 40 years of discovering...
Talent.
And giving them the platform to really not only show what they could do, but... explore themselves what they can do.
And grow on television. That was a crazy thing.
In watching some of the clips of Will Ferrell and in seeing him perform last night, what I thought was so extraordinary, they even showed his audition.
Oh, is that right?
Night, which I'd seen before. And, you know, he had brought so many fully formed characters already with him when he came to the show.
Right.
But what was fascinating about it was to realize that he did do such a variety of characters and sketches. And at the same time... he always held down and during the years deepened this innate quality of who Will Ferrell is as a performer, no matter what that role was. He wasn't quite a chameleon because these characters might be wildly different, but there was always something fundamentally true to the way he plays comedy.
Isn't that fascinating?
In all of them. And I can't really put it into words more.
Now I'm going to have to see his entire, because I've never seen his audition tape. And I imagine that it would be, because even when you see Phil Hartman's audition tape, you see it's fully formed.
It made me wish that they would show more of those. They had Gilda Radner's tape, Dan Aykroyd's tape, Bill Murray's tape. I wish that they'd shown more of those, but that could have filled a full show.
Right.
And why not?
And
Saturday
why not?
Night Live audition tapes as a home video release could be not only great entertainment, but really instructive for young performers, I think.
Like where and how.
And if they could get permission to show those that auditioned and did not get cast.
So many. Kevin Hart and like they had a
Jim
list.
Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey's. I think they're showing
Stephen
those on YouTube.
Stephen Colbert.
Oh, yeah, I know. How would you pass on that?
And that's... many of these performers would, of course, Andy Kaufman, they would nevertheless appear on the show.
Right.
So I wouldn't say that this was the kind of show that made me want to watch Saturday Night Live again. But it made me find that by the end of the night I was rooting for it to continue for many years to come.
Aww.
Because it does seem to me that new generations of comedy fans are being introduced to the form of sketch comedy still through this show.
No, that's good. Well, that is something.
And you see somebody like Andy Samberg, and you know, it's impossible to say that this person isn't without talent and hasn't honed his craft.
Right.
And a big reason why is Saturday Night Live.
Saturday Night Live. It's an opportunity for so many artists.
So another show that we seriously were asked about. Oh, before we let go of the Saturday Night Live, I did want to mention that there's a huge new documentary about Saturday Night Live that is opening this year's Tribeca Film Festival.
No way.
Yeah.
Who put that together?
Bound Winds, live from New York, will open the Tribeca Film Festival on April 15th.
Uh-huh.
It's based on the best-selling oral history of SNL of the same name. And that could be very interesting.
And kind of
interesting. You might actually find that more interesting than ever watching the show
itself. I would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I have the actual, the early 70s annotated history of this SNL.
And I've always found that behind-the-scenes documentaries, if well done, of some of the classic comedy shows are always fascinating to me, even if the sketches that have survived, because when we get back to the Golden Age, a lot of them weren't preserved in any way. But sometimes the sketches that have survived
take on a whole new meaning and depth and light and the whole...
But aren't out of context necessarily that appealing or funny
to
me.
Exactly.
But it's always interesting
to see what
to see the interviews
how.
And what went into it.
Exactly.
And the process.
Love that.
What we put off on discussing last week because it was in the middle of its two-night premiere.
Uh-huh.
But we've been beseeched.
I beseech
besieged us. By we beseeching are... emails, begging to hear our thoughts. I let you start. Dean Hagland, Better Call Saul.
I like it. I like it.
Okay.
Yeah, I've watched it. I've watched the two episodes.
Yeah.
And
in this day and age,
yeah.
For Tuco's appearance to have remained secret.
Yeah.
For so long. And when we say so long, remember, this show was finished in time to air 9 months ago.
I know.
And it was delayed because AMC really wanted to launch it in a huge way.
Yeah.
So they have kept this thing secret.
And how do they do that? And he's already, you know, he's regular.
Given the fervor surrounding this show.
Yeah, and he's always interviewed and promoting Major Crimes, which he is a regular character on. So, you know, the fact that he kept his mouth shut is even more impressive. I think...
I wish I knew the name of the actor who played his lieutenant in Better Call Saul, Tuco's lieutenant in Enterprise.
Yeah.
When he, and this is in episode 2, when he comes over and speaks to Saul when they have Saul held captive in the desert,
and
he comes over and speaks to him, that was the moment where I said, this is a this is a great show that has that is totally separate from Breaking
totally
Bad.
Separate. Absolutely.
And it was that actor and it was that conversation.
Huh.
There's many other good things in it. I think the relationship and the scenes between Bob Odenkirk and Michael McKean as his brother, you know, they crackle with wonderful opportunities.
Yeah.
And the chemistry, definitely. The easy rapport that these two veteran performers have with each other is terrific.
Yeah.
And it would be worth the price of admission alone just to watch that, which is free, I guess. It's basic cable. But
that's the price. It's basic cable.
But really, as a show that can explore an entire world the way that Breaking Bad did, but do so in its own path, with its own voice, boy, those scenes with that lieutenant, and when the lieutenant visits him again at his office.
Yeah, yeah.
So terrific. I went, okay, this really is a show with a lot of opportunity that they're going to explore.
And it is this, you know, I always considered Breaking Bad the great American novel, right? You had healthcare, underpaid teachers, drugs. This was the American experience that touched
That's
so many.
That's a great, great point.
And it's how we, because nobody reads a novel anymore in America, the only way to tell that story was through a limited television series. And now, again, with Better Call Saul, it is the exploration of the desperation. There's a whole nother, I don't, you know, is it as great, the American novel, is it going to bring that many elements of the national experience in? Maybe. But right now it's bringing in that desperation, the, you know, trying to get ahead, the American dream as seen through a lawyer.
Who refuses to be corrupt.
Right. Trying
and as we know where he ends up.
Yeah, it's so amazing.
I'm not a part of the game, he says.
I know.
And we know where he's going to end up.
So you already have, so that, so you're telling the story that you know the end and you've seen the beginning. And so now it's just the depth of that ride. And it's, you know.
Well, and I love that the show opens in as a sequel to Breaking Bad. And as Gilligan promises, Vince Gilligan promises, they're going to be exploring that more, continuing
right.
that storyline, where he's scared for his very life in, you know, the mob version of witness relocation.
Right.
But what's great is he's the manager at a Cinnabon. You know, he works in a mall in a store offering no nourishment whatsoever. It's almost like his work hasn't changed.
Yeah.
When you think about the kind of lawyer that he was.
Right, he wasn't offering
He was a shopping mall lawyer.
That's right. That advertised big, you better call Saul.
And just as Tucker said, I mean, this is Bob Odenkirk is a performer who's been waiting a long time.
And it is shocking to me.
For his turn at the plate.
I've seen him do stand-up.
He's
I remember
so ready.
Mr. Show. I'd seen him on Ben Stiller Show. Remember the little short-lived Ben Stiller Show with Jeanine Garofalo and Andy Dick?
Also playing Stevie Grant, Larry Sanders' agent on the Larry Sanders
That's
Show.
That's right. So, yeah, and so much of that Stevie Grant scene in Saul. But yeah, waiting a long time, and it was just that patience paying off, because you see all of that years of experience in Hollywood in his eyes of just like being like so put upon, like the weight on his shoulders as he stoops around. It totally reminds me of my old agent in New York, actually.
So by the time the second episode ended, I couldn't wait to start episode three. I mean, I just can't wait for tonight's episode.
Yeah,
three.
I'm thinking it's going to be great. I don't know. How many episodes did Vince do? Did he do nine off the top, or is he eight?
No,
eight and 10?
I think they got more than that, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe even 12 to 15.
Wow.
I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
So anyway, hey, let's do this.
One of these things.
Well, every week we like to talk about the Big and Tall Show.
Right.
But there's at least one other, so let's do a live event.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Do you want to mention what's been going on over at The Lash with the Big and Tall Show?
Well, we're a weekly show now, and it's hilarity ensues. And because it's weekly, we have taken some of the pressure off ourselves and allowed other performers to come in and book the show. So last week it was Travis Clark doing the booking, and this week it's Valerie doing the hilarity there. And so I'm not even sure who's on. I was going to start tweeting right after this show and getting the word out there.
Is there anywhere for people who are coming into town and want to see some live comedy that they can check out what the lineup is going to be, where this is, and when?
Yeah, you check out our Facebook, The Big and Tall show on Facebook. We always have the listings of all the acts. And, of course, it's a free show starting at 8:30 every Monday night in downtown Los Angeles. So you can't go wrong there.
So you would have appreciated the event that I participated in.
Maybe. What did you participate in?
The newly renovated, fully renovated, and reopened Frank Lloyd Wright Hollyhock House.
Oh, I read about this.
In Barnsdall Park.
Now, this was a million-dollar renovation, wasn't it?
It was open for free tours for 24 consecutive hours. From 4 p.m. on Friday to 4 p.m. on Saturday, Valentine's Day. We made it up there, up the hill, at about 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night.
Wow.
Stream of unhappy people coming down. What? Coming down. Should we warn them? We hear whispering and all this stuff. Because apparently it took 3 hours to get in because the lines are back up. This was like when I went to see Goodbye to Language, the Jean-Luc Godard film at the Arrow, which is playing in 3D right now in downtown Los Angeles at the Downtown Independent.
Come on.
For, I think, 3 more days.
Come on.
The Goodbye to Language.
Not the Hollyhock thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
No, that's 3D just by walking through it.
Because it is the famous house, his first
but
house.
That,
in Los
that was a happening. It no. was a happening. The big hashtag was right at night.
Nah.
I posed by the hashtag sign up there at the Hollyhock House. And, I mean, there were food trucks up there atop the hill. Just huge lines. It was a big party celebrating this important
piece
jewel
of architecture.
But more than architecture, it's really become this part of Los Angeles cultural history.
Absolutely. And one of the rumors is the couple that lived there wanted to get a divorce but stayed together 10 more years for the sake of the house.
For the sake of the house.
Isn't that great?
I don't advocate staying together for the sake of the children, but for the sake of the house. Because the house will take on the emotional memories. And if you're always going to be fighting, it's going to... Yeah,
no, but the house is big enough that you could live in two parts of it, I suppose.
Of course, many, many people who listen to the show have seen this house, whether they know it or not, when it served as... Rick Deckard's apartment in Blade Runner.
Yes, a lot of those design motifs are taken from Wright's tiles, right? There's individual tiles.
Yeah, you can see it. You can tell. When you walk in, you can absolutely tell.
That's fantastic.
And, of course, the corridor outside Deckard's apartment is the corridor that leads to the front door of the house. Absolutely.
So was there a guided tour?
They were free guided tours.
I understood that this house was in some disrepair and needed like $1.7 million.
It was in disrepair. I may have mentioned this.
Okay.
And I allegedly did this. I might have been up there one weekend and found that the door was unlocked.
What? Went in
and looked at some of the ongoing repair and the... rapidly fading disrepair.
Oh,
yeah,
yeah, right. You didn't go in and add to the damage.
No. Okay. As I spray painted my initials,
it said "Ego is skeleton."
Ego is skeleton. Oh my goodness! I'm so glad you brought this up. So yesterday we visited up at the water tower atop one part of Griffith Park.
Right. Which is where you saw this tag in the first place.
Where I saw the tag in the first place.
Yeah.
And please, everybody, don't bother Googling Ego is Skeleton, because what will happen is what happened to me yesterday. You will find many, many pages referencing Ego is Skeleton, all of which directly lead back to me bringing it up on this show. When I first Googled it, I found one page on all the interwebs, and it was somebody who had posted an Instagram photo of that tag somewhere else in LA.
Right.
So there is a second place where this tag exists, which is to say, if it still exists there, there is now one place where that tag exists because it was painted over. So you can tell it's been painted over, and you can see that there's writing under it. So I've now captured the tag you can no longer read. But
I see.
What I want someone to tell me what Ego is Skeleton means.
Really?
From where is it derived?
Uh-huh.
And why don't they want us to know about it?
Well, perhaps it's a translation from a foreign piece of famous literature. I would suggest? Poorly translated?
I don't know. I don't know. Someone help me. I really want to...
And it's painted over. So we got to find the other one down somewhere in the industrial area. City of Industry?
Well, I'll find out.
Yeah.
You just made up that it was City of Industry.
I sure did.
Did I say it was City of Industry?
No, you said it was on in some industrial wall other than the Instagram photo. I said City of Industry as a way to indicate where it's industrial.
Many greats left us this week, so it's time to do this.
Celebrity deaths.
Wow. I thought we were going to be talking just about broadcasting journalism. Right. But kind of one of my favorites of my formative years died yesterday.
Who would that
93
be?
93 years old. Star of Gigi.
Oh, yes.
Bond villain extraordinaire in Octopussy. The super suave Louis Jordan.
So sad.
Or pronounced Jordan, if you pronounce it correctly.
Right.
Both. I said suave. Did I mention dapper? He
dapper.
Was both suave and dapper. He was a double threat.
Absolutely. And to do Gigi as his career opener, and then to do the Maurice Chevalier role later in his career is like the bookends of how you want your
favorite
career to go.
Favorite quote of his in Gigi? Mine is, "It's a bore. It's a bore." That's one of his numbers, and he says my favorite, which is very close to my favorite quote of his from Octopussy. "It's all in the wrist."
Hilarious.
Yeah, he died. He died Saturday at his Beverly Hills home.
Mm-hmm.
He was born Louis Gendray.
See, that's how I was pronouncing.
On June 19th, that's the same birthday as Lily Holloman.
Look at that.
1921 in Marseille, which is where you would hope he was born,
right.
Quite frankly.
On the border town.
Educated in France, Britain, and Turkey.
Look at that.
Studied to be an actor at the École Dramatique before getting his first film role in 1939, just before World War II.
Wow.
During World War II, when the German Gestapo arrested his father, he and two brothers joined the French Resistance.
I
mean, does he not... I mean, he'll never stop getting cooler and cooler and cooler.
I know.
He put his acting career on hold. He came to the United States in the late 1940s and appeared in films such as Alfred Hitchcock's The Paradine Case, and a film that I've mentioned on this show as being one of my favorites. The great Max Ophuls made a movie called Letter from an Unknown Woman.
Oh, yeah.
And he is so good in this. He's so heartbreaking.
Wow.
He, of course, his breakthrough role was in Vincente Minnelli's adaptation of the beloved French novella Gigi, playing opposite Leslie Caron and, as you said, Marie Chevalier.
Mm-hmm.
The film won 9 Oscars, and Jordan was nominated for a Golden Globe.
Right.
He also appeared in Madame Bovary, and, you know, on and on. But
right.
when I was coming of age, you know, as a teenager, the 1-2 punch of the guy from Gigi playing a Bond villain. And I always liked Bond villains best when they were truly suave, not when they were pretending to be suave.
Right, right.
But truly suave. And Wes Craven's Swamp Thing.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Right.
No, that movie had no business being good, anybody thought.
That's right.
But with Wes Craven at the helm
and
some serious casting behind it.
Yeah.
It really... We talk about tone so often on this show.
Yeah.
But that is a film that by finding the perfect tone... made a movie that defied all expectations.
Absolutely.
And he himself is partly responsible for that, because if you cast him correctly, he did have a certain lighter-than-air quality.
Yeah.
But that served to mask what was hinted at quite often in this, which is a rather sharp sadism.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's right. That evil that lurked
under there. Which is actually on display in Gigi.
Oh, yeah, I guess.
You know, there's a darkness in that film and
that's
in that
true.
Story. I mean, it is a movie about prostitution, for crying out loud.
For crying out loud.
So, anyway, he was awarded France's Legion of Honor in 2010 at a Los Angeles ceremony.
Oh, didn't know the French could...
In his adopted home of Los Angeles.
Ah.
It was, as we said, a bad week for broadcasting. I guess I said that.
You said it.
You agreed silently.
I silently. I raised my eyebrows and looked askew.
Last week, as our explanation of the week, we discussed what might have
brought
Ryan Williams to his current predicament.
Right.
And, you know, the more that I thought about it in advance of that show and since then, you know, I certainly wish nothing but ill upon Ryan Williams.
Really?
Yeah. And you know, and certainly him stepping away proved not to be enough. And NBC has now suspended him, I think they said, for 6 months.
Yeah.
That really smacks of a... you know, a trial balloon. If our ratings don't completely crater,
right?
He's gone.
He's gone.
And I certainly hope he's never allowed to come back, really. Not to hold it against him, and not because I think he's the only one. It's like steroids in sports, right?
Exactly.
I have a feeling they're all doing it.
They're all doing it. But he's just the one that's got caught.
At some point, and if you got caught... that is far from the only time you did it. And indeed, so many stories have come out about him since then.
Absolutely.
But at some point, we really, if we want to reclaim a fourth estate that serves its function, and we need to.
Yeah.
We need to have people whose job it is to hold to the fire the feet of those with power.
Right.
We need that.
Yeah.
And if we're ever going to reclaim such a fourth estate... examples need to be made of people who take such a solemn responsibility. And
but here again, I think this is the...
it's another reason why I think Better Call Saul is an interesting show at this time.
Taking the responsibility.
I'm not going to be a part of that game.
Right, I'm not.
And yet we know he is going to be.
Right.
It's like we're watching the Brian Williams story.
Ouch. Yeah, you know, here's the thing. It's also, I see this story now about ego.
Which is skeleton, I believe.
It is skeleton. This is the skeleton of the ego that we see now manifested before us. In that it's ripped him asunder because... you know, you're a newsreader. You're on TV every night. You get fame. You get some power. And in that power, you want to be a serious journalist. So clearly you are couched in a second helicopter. You are, you know, you're padded from whatever reporting you do. Mm-hmm. But in order that you wanted to be authentic, you wanted to be a journalist in the field, you embellish your story because you know they would never actually just put you in a flak jacket in the middle of a war zone.
Boy, this brings up a really interesting point about our next celebrity death. That's really, I'd never thought about that before. Because there's been a real question about this person's death. But, you know, again, to Brian Williams, you know, I think the way that so many... easy jokes were made of it last night at Saturday Night Live. Obviously made the interviewers, you know, these were former colleagues. It was on NBC. These are former colleagues of Brian Williams. And it clearly made everybody uncomfortable and they all fell flat. They were all just easy prey. It wasn't until Jerry Seinfeld comes out during the show and is talking about the great lore of Saturday Night Live and the fact that he just found out backstage that Brian Williams apparently was one of the original not ready for primetime players.
Nah.
And then he stops and he goes, I was told that. I mean, it doesn't sound true, but I mean, if he says it's true, it must be true. I suddenly realized, you know, this is now Seinfeld.
Right.
And this is now on NBC's flagship.
Right.
Talking about NBC's Anchorman, it reminded me for a moment of the kind of power that Carson wielded. And the moment that Seinfeld came out with this and his delivery, which is so, you know, perfect.
Right, right.
It wasn't that the joke per se was great, but the way that he delivered it was so perfect. And in that moment, I went, this man's career is dead.
It's kind of dead.
That's it.
It's kind of not
It was a Carson-esque moment. You know, that old adage that if Carson made fun of you, told jokes about you three nights in a row, you were gone.
They were done. Yeah, it seems that way, unfortunately. And it's hard to bounce back from that. I mean, what do you do? How do you become truthful again?
And
you're always then circumspect.
And so amazing what you brought up, because this you know, incident with Brian Williams and the aftermath of it taking place in the juxtaposition of the death of journalist and acclaimed journalist Bob Simon,
right,
from 60 Minutes,
right,
who dies at 73
in a New York cab,
a livery cab
of a guy whose license was suspended 9 times, which is always what I think every time I go in those cabs. None of those are safe.
And a lot of people were saying, "Well, why wasn't he wearing, you know, a seatbelt? If he wore a seatbelt, he would have survived." Certainly, as a man who's been around the world, a journalist, a traveled man, he would know better. I got to ask you, when you're in the back of a cab where it's not a legal requirement to wear a seatbelt,
yeah,
In New York, certainly.
Right, right.
Do you
well,
buckle up?
I used to when they used to have those pre-recorded Joan Rivers and Eartha Kitt's purring in the speakers that told you to buckle up.
I think I do.
I do
a lot because, especially if it's going to be any lengthy kind of trip, because I tend to want to nap.
Well, yeah, if it's bumper to bumper on Fifth Avenue, no. But if I'm hightailing it down one of the freeways on the outskirts, I'm buckled in.
But you also do wonder, you know, I mean, it just made me think of that and that question with what you were saying. I mean, it's almost this, no, I sort of would expect someone like this wouldn't buckle up.
Yeah.
I would sort of expect that this person who liked being immersed in it
in the danger
would enjoy the immediacy of any experience.
I guess.
He's not buckling up for safety, no matter the experience.
Right, but he's lived through so many other dangerous situations.
And let's talk about what he lived through. I mean, this guy's career, this guy's a journalist, right? 47-year career at CBS News.
Man.
Earned more than 40 awards, including 27 Emmys.
Wow.
Believed to be the most ever for a field reporter. And he won 4 Peabody Awards for Excellence in Broadcasting. 5-decade career took him through almost every major overseas conflict spanning from the late 1960s to the present.
Mm-hmm.
Joined NBC News in 67 as a New York-based reporter and assignment editor covering campus unrest and inner city riots.
Remember that?
Yeah, there's a time where you're thrown right into the mix.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? We're just going to give you a local assignment. Oh, that sounds safe. I want to do something dangerous. Here, there's riots outside.
Yeah, exactly. Cover that.
He worked in CBS News Tel Aviv Bureau from 77 to 81.
Wow. When there was a Tel Aviv Bureau.
The Israeli-Egyptian
War. Yes, exactly.
Ongoing.
Yom Kippur.
Worked in Washington, D.C. as the network State Department correspondent. That's where I really came to know his work.
Right.
His career in war reporting was extensive, beginning in Vietnam. While based in Saigon from 71 to 72, his reports on the war, and particularly the Hanoi 1972 Spring Offensive, won him the Overseas Press Club Award for the best radio news coverage for the end of the conflict.
Wow, radio news.
He was there for the end of the conflict and was aboard one of the last helicopters out of Saigon in 1975 and never claimed that helicopter took fire.
That, because it did.
You see what I did
like
right
you
there?
Did.
Again, Middle East correspondent in 1987, became the leading broadcast journalist in the region, worked in Tel Aviv for more than 20 years.
Wow.
During the early days of the Persian Gulf War in 91, he was imprisoned and tortured by the Iraqi army, along with 3 CBS News colleagues. He later chronicled the experience in his book, 40 Days. In 1996, he won 1 more Overseas Press Club Award, a Peabody Award, and 2 Emmy Awards for his coverage of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's assassination.
Right.
Still in the 21st century, able to get major interviews for 60 Minutes, including the first Western interview with extremist Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr.
Right.
And, another with his rival, who was killed shortly after the interview.
And you know that this guy's getting this kind of respect. And I know guys like Brian Williams, who think they're just, you know, newsreaders, desk jockeys, I'm sure they get mocked at that. And that is the motive, the impetus behind why he embellished those stories, Brian Williams, because you see that.
Because you're not that guy.
You're not that guy. You're not getting Peabody Awards. You're reading from a teleprompter.
But also there's a degree to which Bob Simon was not a household name, even despite all that.
Yes.
But still kept doing it. But you see the impact that his stories had culturally. One of the movies that was talked about so much that it even made my list as one of the 2 worst films of last year, Unbroken. Supposedly about the life story of Louis Zamperini, which was so much more interesting than the story depicted in that movie.
Right.
But Louis Zamperini came to public attention, really, because of a 30-minute report that Bob Simon did on him during the 1998 Olympic Games.
Look at that.
His most recent piece for 60 Minutes aired last weekend, and it was a conversation with Ava DuVernay, the really talented young director of the Academy-nominated film Selma.
Look at that.
So that is quite the career, and
that
hard not
career.
To. Now, on a more local basis, certainly not the globe-trotting, award-winning journalist that Bob Simon was, but significantly still a major part of the fabric of the local broadcasting news scene for many decades. Mm-hmm. Local reporter Stan Chambers died.
Really?
At 91 years of age. Uh-huh. His career spanned more than six decades at one station.
Holy.
KTLA Channel 5. When I first moved to Los Angeles in the late 80s.
Yes.
You watched, even at my age, you watched the 10 o'clock KTLA news.
Right.
Because you would actually find out what was going on in the city.
Right. Locally.
Yeah. I think now about how every news, I can't stop thinking of how great this movie Nightcrawler is with Jake Gyllenhaal, because every local news thing begins with violent stories.
Right.
Shooting deaths, you know, at a time when violent crime is at an all-time low and getting lower.
I know.
But more and more time is dedicated towards it.
Yeah.
But you watched the KTLA Channel 5 news to find out what was actually going on in the city.
Right.
And with their legendary anchorman, Hal Fishman.
I'm Hal Fishman, which I think Kev Brockman was to,
of course, yeah, was based on.
Right.
Yeah, in Simpsons. But, and I always, Hal Fishman died at 76. And the saddest thing for me about how these men went was I always thought that they would go in some hand-holding Thelma and Louise-esque blaze of glory. And that, to me, was the great disappointment.
Yeah.
But this is the thing, is like, he was already well along in his years, Stan Chambers, by the time I moved here. But friends of mine who grew up here would talk about how, like, one of their biggest thrills would be if they ever got interviewed by Stan Chambers, because that would happen,
right,
you know, related to various things. And that would be the big deal.
Stan Chambers talked to me.
Yeah, Stan Chambers talked to me. He was that much a part of Los Angeles, culture and fabric and community. Finally, one other great broadcasting loss, Gary Owens, who I adored as a kid. This
Absolutely.
Guy made me want to be an announcer for
an
a short period of
from
time.
From laughing.
And he was the original host of The Gong Show.
Oh, that's right. I remember that before Chuck Barris screwed it all up.
And, of course, coined the phrase from beautiful downtown Burbank.
That's right. He was also the voice in Scooby-Doo, wasn't he?
No, you're thinking Casey Kasem.
I am.
Yeah.
That's exactly who I'm thinking.
He as you said, vaulted to fame as the zany announcer in the landmark comedy series, Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. He never failed for work after that point.
No. I mean, boy, that voice.
And he also would ad-lib so much as the announcer.
Yeah.
On that show, just to keep things moving. They said he was constantly ad-libbing. And George Slaughter was so grateful
for
his contributions.
Because he's covering for so many gaps that otherwise would have been, if he was just reading the copy on that show, there would have been so much dead air. They would have to edit like crazy.
Speaking of dead air.
What? Is that what we call this segment now?
50 Shades of Grey opened this weekend.
Ugh.
Huge hit. Not only the movie, but the film, right? Huge hit around the world. Biggest February opening ever.
Right, because everybody read the book.
I thought at first, of course, it was going to be a biopic about my goatee, 50 Shades of Grey. Listen, I love when people love things, right? Of
good
course.
For them.
Good for them for loving things.
That thing.
My first response to the success of this, or even to this being made in the first place,
right,
was the same response I had the day I was in New York to attend the only ever screening on these shores of my English language modern day remake of The Story of O, and I call it mine, but as we know, there were a lot of cooks in that kitchen. But I was attending New York Film Festival for the only ever, what ended up being the only ever screening of the film in these shores for legal reasons and MPAA ratings reasons.
Right.
And earlier in the week saw this brand new film, Secretary.
Oh, yes. With James
Spader and Maggie Gyllenhaal. And I said to myself, there is no need for the movie that I just made after seeing Secretary.
Right.
And when I heard about 50 Shades of Grey, I thought of Secretary and thought, there is no need for 50 Shades of Grey.
And apparently,
See Secretary
with James Spader. Who?
Or see it by yourself, or see it with someone you love, and you'll enjoy James Spader being in it.
See what you did?
He hates watching himself, you know that.
But, you know, he's got some time, maybe.
But, you know, here's the thing. Again, you know, people want to see the stories that they want to see, and right. they want to go to movies, and they're going to, and I would never deny them that. At the same time, let me issue a cautionary note.
Okay.
That your money has power.
Right.
And if you spend it towards seeing really, really shitty works, then really, really shitty works are going to promulgate.
Exactly.
That's what Hollywood is going to put their muscle behind. Let them eat cake. And when I say cake, I mean shitty movies. Now, Hollywood, let me issue a cautionary note. Just because it's something that you know the people want doesn't mean that you are absolved of the responsibility of trying to do it in an artistic, meaningful way.
Exactly. So put some craft to it.
When Nicholas Meyer took over the Star Trek franchise, mm-hmm. he had the very refreshing attitude, knowing that any changes he made were going to engender animosity from a really fervent fan base.
Right.
But he said, look, this has been very popular and very successful. My responsibility is to honor the best of this work.
Right.
Because it is popular and successful. I want to honor the best of it.
Okay.
My responsibility as a storyteller is to improve all of that which is not good within it.
Very good.
And that was his attitude. And I wish more storytellers took their approach
right.
That way.
Because I saw The Kingsman.
As did I. Brilliant counter-programming. Is this not?
It's so brilliant.
When was the last time two R-rated movies did the kind of box office on the same weekend that this did? It was the hugest President's Day weekend at the box office ever.
Right.
4-day weekend, you've got 50 Shades of Grey in excess of $90 million domestically. You've got Kingsman in excess of $40 million domestically. Looks like it'll edge out the SpongeBob movie
right.
for second place, which is no small thing given the family business surrounding the SpongeBob movie.
Right.
But we always talk about counter-programming and releasing films year-round, and that is brilliant counter-programming.
Because it's Valentine's Day, and if you're not into that, you want to see something so far away from that, and Kingsman delivers.
CinemaScore, which is always overrated, because when people pay to see something, they always artificially inflate what they thought of it, because nobody wants to feel like you wasted your money and your time.
Right.
But the cinema score for I loved how Deadline Hollywood put it, the cinema score from audiences who paid to see 50 Shades of Grey was an abysmal C. To have a C on opening weekend,
ouch,
it's almost unheard of.
Yeah,
you have to be like the most vile slasher pick that somehow managed to sequester nuns and old people into the audience to get a lower score than that.
Right.
But what Deadline pointed out was that it really was a terrible score, because those men, and the majority of people who went to see 50 Shades of Grey were women,
right,
which I guess I understand, but like women going with each other to go see 50 Shades of Grey seems weird to me.
That does seem weird.
But anyway, hey, let's go see grandma porn. But the men apparently, you know, gave it a really atrocious and unheard of C cinema score, and that's why it was so low. The women gave it a C+. And that's substantially better.
That's
as opposed to Kingsman, which got an A-,
right,
audience score,
and rightly so.
And
highly entertaining.
Really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
You know, this Matthew Vaughn
feller
who directed it and who directed
Kick-Ass,
X-Men: First Class.
Mm-hmm.
See, did he direct Kick-Ass? I mean, this is the stumbling point, really.
Right.
You know, that, you know, he does the Great Layer Cake,
right?
He supposedly does Kick-Ass, though, as I said, you know, the problem with Kick-Ass is the first half doesn't feel like Matthew Vaughn directed it at all.
True, studio.
It could have been anyone.
Yeah.
The second half has Matthew Vaughn's fingerprints all of it and doesn't work.
Right.
So, and then he has nothing to do with the sequel. So it makes me want to know...
What happened?
What's the story behind that film? Because he goes and he does First Class. And now working with the real restrictions of having a studio franchise where you're not allowed to really imbue your own personality in it, he nevertheless works against those limitations to concoct the most lighthearted and entertaining X-Men movie there was.
Absolutely.
He then gets replaced on the follow-up when Bryan Singer decides, I'm back. I'm back to the franchise I made great. And you watch last summer's pretty good X-Men movie, but the tone of it makes you wish
you
that Matthew Vaughn could still be the director of
yes.
it.
Yes.
And I wonder if that's why he got the budget that he did from Fox to do such a, you know, a relatively high-budget, R-rated film.
Right. I mean,
that is more outrageous, rivals the outrageousness of Seth Rogen's The Interview.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, in terms of world leaders blowing
and
up.
Yet, and yet, at a much bigger budget.
Interesting.
And so why does he get that? Well, I wonder if it's because, you know, this is someone who's learned through the battles of Hollywood, don't complain, keep your nose down, don't badmouth anyone around you, because we've never heard from him, as far as I know, badmouthing about the Kick-Ass experience.
No.
We've never heard badmouthing about him getting replaced on the next X-Men after kind of paving the way for a future for that franchise.
Right.
And so he gets what he needs to make this rather unique vision come to life in Kingsman.
Yeah.
It's not for everyone. I do compare it to The Interview with good reason. I mean, you know, if Sony is under so much attack for a film that shows Kim Jong-un's head exploding, how about every world leader, including Obama's head, exploding?
Even though they try to say it's not Obama's head.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Obama's head.
Yeah, they both say that it has to look like Obama because we want to show the stakes that are involved. Right. But we're not really blowing up Obama.
Right.
So what you're saying is it's a character that's supposed to look like Obama, but you didn't really blow up our president. Okay, gotcha.
Gotcha. We love it.
I got that.
But it was so comedic. I mean, his stylized violence with alternative soundtracks behind it. I mean, in Kick-Ass, the young girl kicking everybody in a brutally grotesque, gruesome fight while they're playing a punk version of the Bananas theme song.
Yeah, I mean, it was very Kubrick-esque how he would do things like this. I thought it was more actually subversive in Kingsman. It was more subversive because... like you have Casey and the Sunshine Band's Give It Up.
Yeah,
though when it was released, it was only released as a solo single for Harry Wayne Casey. I want everyone to know that. Wow. I have it on vinyl. But I loved hearing that in a big screen in a theater.
Yeah.
And it's playing whenever this signal's being sent out that's leading to global destruction. But then whenever the Kingsmen are able to subvert that signal, then we go back to the music score of the film.
Yeah.
And it's so subversive because I keep wanting the villain to be able to succeed so I can keep hearing this great song in the fantastic sound system, how I've never heard it before, as opposed to the rote spy theme that is boring like we've heard so many times before. And there's so many moments like this in the movie where they get you rooting for the thing you should not be rooting for.
Absolutely.
And that's subversive.
That is subversive. And so
The hate church, the Colin Firth's tour de force, a balletic tour de force. I understand that it's accomplished through a great many camera tricks and post-production tricks,
but
you can't tell me that Colin Firth did not have to train his ass off.
I know.
A man his age, through really dance training because of the flexibility required of that.
Yeah, there isn't enough CGI in the world that could fake you walking through a scene like that. You can't phone that one in, and it goes from shocking to hilarious to shocking to more hilarious to at the end completely shocking and hilarious at the same time. You know, I'm squeamish at screen violence at the best of times, but to have me laughing and be squeamish at the same time is a rare feat for any movie to do to me.
And again, puts you in the position. This is not no spoiler alert required, but that very feeling puts you in the position of the film's villain, does it not?
It does. It's very exactly, and it's so unique.
I have some minor criticisms of it where certain things they didn't connect the dots on. They didn't really hit their target. They missed a couple of opportunities.
Science things that don't make sense.
Often that is to complain for what the film isn't rather than for what it is. I will also say this, though, that at the same time that we're going down this road, I kept thinking, a great film could be made of this exact story if it was played totally straight and serious in a low budget way.
Absolutely.
Everything about this would make for a riveting kind of small potboiler spy thriller.
Handheld,
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy almost kind of way.
I know.
And that's when you're really into some fun material, when you know that multiple different approaches could be exciting.
So we agree. Skip Shades of Grey and go see Kingsman.
You know what I saw? We're going long because, as you know, we have to add a little public service announcement at the end.
Oh.
But we'll conclude our regular broadcasting day with this, which is a doff of the cap to Dean Haglund's top 10 list, wherein he included Mike Lee's Mr. Turner.
Oh, yeah.
I saw this weekend, and a film that, again, demands to be seen on the big screen.
Has to be.
Boy, the widescreen use, I think it's 233. It is ultra wide screen in the scope, and
seen in IMAX.
And some of the transitions of his painting to the world around it, and really, again, as all films should do, letting you see the world and experience the world the way that the characters see it and experience it.
Right.
And this film really takes its time to lure you into what it's doing, but you really get a sense for how he experienced the world, and also a really gritty sense of what it was like to live at that time.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, this is the thing I hate so much when I go to museums nowadays, that it's the new... to the new church, and everybody rushes through these things. You run to see your hits, and then you bugger off. And in order to get back into the headspace of the artist who created it in a different time in the 1700s, where it was a slower time, you have to slow down in the galleries, and this movie does that really well, of slowing it down. And my God, I'm going to see it again. That's what I'm going to do, seriously.
Excellent. Well, we'll talk about that and so many more things 2 weeks from now.
Right.
When we return. Next week, of course, is our big Oscar
show.
Smackdown. We've already gone long, but we promised to do this. There's a very talented young woman named Lindsay Gold who appeared on the Midweek Drive, the UK radio show. Mm-hmm. It is my privilege to participate in each and every week. And she has an Indiegogo campaign to finance her first full EP.
Ah.
And, you know, we talk so much about how culturally, say it again, the snake has eaten its tail.
Shit it out and eaten that.
And eaten that.
Yeah.
You know, everything is reboots, remakes, sequels, homages, pastiches based on other works.
Exactly.
Where, you know, we've gone through modernism, postmodernism, deconstructivism. When do we get creativity? That's the question. I don't see a lot of just out and out original creative expression.
Right.
And it's people like Lindsay who come along, whose music and voice might be evocative of a Kate Bush.
Right.
But at the same time, it's so unique. And to hear such a unique voice from someone so young is the sort of thing that gives this old timer some real optimism and hope culturally. And I do find this in a lot of young performers and young writers, actually. I feel like they do want to make a fresh break of things, and no matter what their particular medium of choice is. So again, her name is Lindsay Gold. We'll link to her Indiegogo page.
Right.
But if nothing else, please listen to this song. And if you enjoy it, forward it along to people. Because as we know, one of the important things of these crowdsourcing campaigns is that it's free marketing.
Yes.
People. It gets people to hear and see their work who otherwise never would.
So even if you can't contribute, just pass it forward.
If you like the song, forward it along.
Yep.
And we'll just cut it in at the end of the show.
Yep.
It's Lindsay Gold, and until next week, I'm Phil Lerner.
I'm Dean Haglund.